She was to pay me $2,000 a month, and then she would own the house. She paid me $1,500 for, I think it was 2 months, and then nothing. What she took was $148,000. Then we couldn't find her.
He was a fantastic guy that could convince people. He'd tell me to go to a bank. I'd go to the bank and write out a check for $1,000 or $2,000, and I'd give him the cash. And, oh, he's going to be millionaires in no time. I'll never see that $40,000, $50,000.
Harry had no family at all. He had nobody looking in on what was going on. Therefore, they got everything. He was willing to trust anybody who was going to tell him anything.
My mother had a knee replacement surgery, and while we were just in a conversation talking about her house and how long she, you know, really planned to live in her house and did, had she thought about moving and what that might mean, and she said, well, no, she really hadn't, and she thought moving would be really expensive, and she didn't have any money, is the way she put it. And we were, my sister and I were kind of perplexed because we knew she's not a big spender by any means. She has a good annuity. She was a government employee for years, so she has a good retirement. And we couldn't really figure out what she meant about that, so we kind of probed into it more. And finally, she kind of blurted out, well, I'm paying this credit card bill. And so we said, a credit card bill for who or for what? What did you buy, you know, just in general? And she said, well, it's not my bill, really. It belongs to your cousin. And to my shock, the balance was over $20,000.
I've been living here in my apartment now for 16 years, and all 16 of those years I have lived next door to Harry and Grace. And Grace passed away in 1988 and left Harry alone. He has no family. They had no children. He missed Grace so much, he told everybody how many days, how many minutes, and how many seconds it had been since she'd passed away. Harry was at the bus stop at the corner of MacArthur and High Street and was speaking to somebody about the loss of his wife, Grace. And they chimed in at the bus stop saying, Grace, I worked with Grace at Mother's Cookies. They led him to believe that they worked with her and knew her and that she liked them. And that was enough for him to dedicate the rest of his life to them. They got him to sign over the deed to his house. They wiped him out.
I was amazed. You know, we were all down there in a kind of a crisis situation right after my dad died. And I was amazed at the number of telemarketing calls that just came out of the woodwork.
Well, like the two yesterday, they called and said I had been nominated for a big prize. I had so many chances of winning and all this sort of thing. And I said, I'm sorry, I'm not interested. Even though I could use the money. And then I had another call where this man said that I had won lots of money, but I had to go to Western Union and send $1,000. And there seemed to be so many scams going on.
There's an awful lot of stuff coming in through the mail. And some of these direct mail operations, you know, are reading the obituary. I mean, I picked one up that said, we're sorry about your loss. And oh, by the way, would you like to look at one of our great memorial headstones? And I'm like, oh, give me a break.
My mother had suddenly gone from very independent driving a car to needing round-the-clock nursing care. She had grown quite dependent upon this woman. She gave my mother wonderful care. She was an expert. But the empirical evidence began to tell a story, which sort of happened as, you know, it's shocking to think this, but virtually unbeknownst to me. $2,000 or $3,000 checks every couple of days. It was a slow hemorrhaging of these monies.
I'm Margaret Thaler, singer. I'm 76 years of age and a retired psychology professor from the University of California, Berkeley. And my main area of research for many years has been, how do people go about influencing one another? People can influence other people by three ways. They can educate or reason with people. They can coerce them, or they can trick them. Coercion and trickery are what those of us that are studying elder abuse are exploring at the moment. How do people go about tricking the elderly, or as the law calls it, how do they go about wielding undue influence over the elderly?
Harry Champion was a victim of a sweetheart scam by a woman by the name of Venus. When he met Venus, he was about 80. One of the first things they did was get him to give her money for an operation she needed. She was pregnant, claiming to Harry that she needed a cancer operation, tumor operation removed. He went down to the bank, took out a mortgage on the house, and gave her the cash, $38,000.
Most men that are in their, you know, 70s and 80s now, grew up in an era where they had to think of themselves like the John Wayne, the muscle man, the hero. And when they get more elderly, they don't quite know how to properly ask for legal help, physical help.
He was still in the 30s and the 40s with the way he behaved, and he wore a fedora and he tipped his hat. He really did have a difficult time asking for help. I don't think he ever knew he needed it. He was used to taking care of everybody else in his life, not taking care of himself.
The elderly women, on the other hand, didn't have much practice doing their own financial management. They weren't out dealing with the world. And when their partner dies, they are then at the mercy of both conniving relatives and conniving outsiders who know how very dependent ladies in their 70s and 80s can be.
I was a very protected wife. My husband was the county clerk and recorder here. If he handed me something to sign, I signed it without any question. And he took care of the rest of it. I never paid any attention. This never would have happened if he hadn't died. I wouldn't have applied for a mortgage or anything like that. Saturday night, I said, "Have you decided what attorney I should go to if anything happens to you?" And he said, "No, I've been thinking about it, but," he said, "I've almost made up my mind. And I can see it yet. It's just like it happened yesterday." And the next morning he got up, and I got up about a half hour after he did and found him on the sofa, slumped over. And I miss him more every day.
My father and I had talked quite a bit before he died because we both were concerned that my mother's kind of a classic sitting duck of an older person, in that she's been sort of a 40s woman who did not stay in touch with her financial affairs, because that was something she was happy to leave to my father. One of the things that we did was put all of the family's assets, all of my parents' assets, in a trust. And that gave us some immediate shielding when my father died. It meant that none of their assets ever had to be listed in a public record. And so that really kept knowledge of my mother's assets out of the hands of some of the more unscrupulous people that tend to watch the obituaries and go through the probate court records looking for that kind of data.
But didn't know how to ask me, and she always gives me the answer, "Well, you're so busy, and I hate to bother you, and I know you work, and you have your life, and I don't want to bug you and be a burden." And so that part of it is probably the biggest part, to help convince them that they're not a burden to you, that you're doing anything that they need you to do, because they've always done the same for you as a child and growing up. So it's hard to help them, let them see that they need to let you help, too. We kind of plan things now where we'll say, okay, on the third Saturday or whatever, we'll get together and go to lunch, and we'll look at whatever's going on with the bills or talk about her doctor's appointments. It's not real easy. It's not easy to talk to her about her finances. she's earned her money and has worked long and hard, and I don't want to dictate to her what she should or shouldn't do. And if she felt like she wanted to buy something for someone or loan someone money or give them money, I feel like that's her right to do it, as long as, again, it's not putting her in a bad situation.
One of the things I do just to make sure I never surprise her is I always talk with her about what I'm doing. Like when I do the bills, I have been following the practice of sitting down with her and telling her all the bills she has that are due. And I make out the checks, but I never sign them, even though I have power of attorney. I make her sign them just so she's still engaged in, you know, making these decisions about where her money goes. Mainly, I try to give her the sense when we work together on this stuff that we're operating as a team. Sometimes I stop and I remind Mom just how things work, that her pension goes into this bank account and the mutual funds are held in the trust, and she basically doesn't have to worry about them. They're on automatic pilot.
I think she might have wanted, you know, some assistance.
I have put a signal on my telephone with my friends and my neighbors. They ring twice, hang up, and dial again. Then I know it's somebody I want to talk to.
I guess one of the things that could be helpful to think about, too, is helping them open their mail or just taking a look at it with their permission to see what kind of solicitations they're receiving. Being sure that you talk about financial issues if you hear something on the news about credit card fraud or things that are going on with elderly people, bring it up. And sometimes that can get them talking about what's going on with them. Like, oh, yeah, well, I got one of those, or I've seen that too, or someone's called and asked me for that. And just tell them, you know, that you shouldn't give your credit card number over the phone, and give them some tips so that they can still stay in control, but they're kind of more aware of the sophisticated ways people can take advantage of you these days without even thinking about it.
We did a couple of things to make it harder for people that were using high-pressure telephone and direct mail tactics to get to her. We immediately put her on caller ID and also ordered call blocking, which was a service I didn't even know about until we got into this, where if you put call blocking on your phone, it means that long-distance anonymous phone calls can't get through, and most of those calls are telemarketers. It didn't cut down on the local telemarketers. It wouldn't screen those guys out. But at least with caller ID, we knew who was calling. I also put a phone answering machine on my mother's phone. One of the things we learned was that if a person does not pick up the phone, most telemarketers will hang up. So we're trying to get my mother trained to wait through the number of rings until she hears who's talking. And if she hears that it's a familiar voice like myself or somebody in the family or a friend, to go ahead and pick up, and the machine will stop and she can go ahead and have a conversation. We tried to make it really okay for Mom to call us about anything. We just said, look, I don't care how crazy you think it is, but if a phone call that you get worries you, or if someone calls demanding payment and you don't think it's real, just call us any time of the day or night. And so we posted right by the phone a list of all of the kids, all of our spouses, all of our numbers, both at home and at work. So no matter where we were, she could always get to one of us.
Become aware of any declines in mental functioning. Be very aware that if there are capacity changes, that means the capacity to consent is declining, and therefore the person is more vulnerable to influence.
We set up some protections, like that the trust is structured so that two trustees have to act together, that nobody can ever act alone, so that my mother, you know, couldn't be scammed by somebody coming to the door and be able to give them money without one of us, of the children, knowing about it. We also put everything on direct deposit so that she never has to worry about live checks coming to the house and running to the bank. So she just never had to worry about missing a check and having it stolen.
I got a revocable living trust And I got my a guardian, which has to sign everything. And I've known her for 25 years, and she's watching over me. It's nice to have a guardian. She helps me in all kinds of things. She's fantastic. And anytime I call her, she's always helping with everything.
One of the things that I was really surprised about is the extent that my cousin was able to use the account without ever having a physical credit card. So it shocked me to see that people can still use just a number without having a physical card. I would suggest then, because of that and finding out that it is so easy to use a credit card account with just a number, I would encourage people to discourage their family to give their credit card number to anybody under any circumstances, because it is a clear asset. And just tell them, you know that you shouldn't give your credit card number over the phone, and give them some tips so that they can still stay in control, but they're kind of more aware of the sophisticated ways people can take advantage of you these days without even thinking about it.
Always remember, we're looking for the welfare rights of the elderly to have free will and free and independent choice. And undue influence means that a person who is a trusted person is using their power and authority to keep the elderly person from exercising free will and from exercising free and independent choice.
I had actually been very slow to suspect any wrongdoing. I remember my wife's father, he said, "This guy is robbing you." And I blew up at him and I told him, "You don't know this accountant. He's a friend of the family. He'd never do this." I had a hard time believing that this was happening because I wanted so to believe that these people around my mother really cared about her and had her welfare at heart and were honest. I didn't want to believe what my father-in-law said was true about them. And I had my head pretty much in the sand.
The way I knew there was a problem was Harry was no longer able to feed himself. He had no money. He just was no longer being as sharp as he used to be. There also were some very bizarre things missing from the house. There was no crystal, no china. They had wiped him out.
He is a real smooth talker. What we were going to do was put up the money. He'd buy the equipment, and we could process all this gold. And we was going to be millionaires in no time. He'd tell me to go to the bank. I'd go to the bank and write out a check for $1,000 or $2,000, and the bank would give me cash, and I'd give him the cash. He said he didn't want to fool around checks, so that's what I did with all of it. So anyway, I kept on giving him money, and all of it is nothing but a lie. But I believed it. I wanted any more. You know, you got to use your... I use what few brains I got. But they're disappearing, I guess, because I don't have the memory anymore like I used to.
Mental capacity is a collection of the mental skills that we have that we use to get through our lives. It's things like memory, remembering today what you did yesterday. It's also the ability to calculate. If I give you this much money, this is how much change I can expect. It's the ability to reason. Capacity fluctuates. It changes. It can be affected by a lot of factors like nutrition or illness or the kinds of medications that somebody takes. And so it's often really hard to get a good read on whether or not somebody is really using good judgment or not. The reason that the concept of capacity is so important in talking about elder financial abuse is because oftentimes what will happen in these situations is that somebody will appropriate property or a home by getting the older person to sign something, to sign a deed or to sign a power of attorney. Now, that document is only good if that person had the mental capacity. It's only legal if they had the mental capacity that ensured that they really understood what they were doing.
I was short of money, so I decided that I would apply for a reverse mortgage loan. The lady that was handling it, I thought was very honest, and my neighbors knew her, or I thought they knew her. She had her own business, something strategies, and I had never heard of that mortgage company. And I did sign the mortgage paper. I thought that's the way it was handled. And some of it was blank. They said initial here, initial here. And they did it in a hurry, which should have put me wise, but it didn't. And I just assumed that's the way a reverse mortgage worked. Well, apparently what she got was papers signed by me. Then she got $148,000 and took off.
Undue influence is the legal term. That means people are using their role as authority figures, either as a nurse, as a doctor, as an accountant, as a lawyer, or just their personal forcefulness to impose their will on the older person.
The things that they were able to do and get him to do were incredible, leading him to believe that they really cared about him. And this was a part of their game. Harry, save your money and we will get married. Well, he would save his money, save cash in a Band-Aid box in his refrigerator. They would show up. Harry, I can't find a place to live. I need to borrow some money. Can I borrow some money? And they would wipe him out. And then he'd be starting all over again from scratch, saving money to get married.
These are the kind of conditions to watch for. If you're an elderly person or you're the relative of an elderly person, was a document, a transfer of property, the creating of a will, done at an unusual or inappropriate time? Was it done in an unusual place? Was there a push by the people who got the elderly person to sign documents such as contracts or wills? Were they hurrying the person? The court will also look if there were multiple persuaders present with one elderly man or woman. The court will also ask, were third-party advocates such as financial advisors or attorneys present to give advice to the elderly person? These are the kinds of conditions that courts look at to see if someone unduly influenced a person. One of the ways for both relatives and people who are taking care of the elderly to inspect what's going on is to start becoming aware of anyone who is trying to get an older person isolated and sequestered. And in isolating them, what they do is they start to monitor the telephone, the mail, who comes to the door, and they send the relatives away or the visitors away. Because they're on their way as a controller and an improper influencer to create what I call a siege mentality, where they get the older person to feeling very dependent on them, feeling a sense of powerlessness, feeling fearful and vulnerable, and that they need this caretaker or this relative. And it makes that single caretaker seem to be the source of all things, the direct pipeline to being cared for.
When he met Venus, he was about 80. She'd call at very odd hours, midnight, 2 o'clock in the morning, and then tell him to be home, she was coming to visit, and then she would never show. And then he would worry for days about where she had been, and he wouldn't sleep. He wouldn't be able to eat. She would tell him lies and lead him along, and he believed them and then would worry when nothing would happen. Harry was very, very ashamed of what had happened. He did not want to be seen as somebody who was a fool. He was very heartsick that Venus really did not love him. He was devastated, and he did not recover from all that had been done to him.
When we first started trying to deal with this, I knew it upset my mother very much that this was going on. And that also, because I was so upset about it, that bothered her too. I didn't want you to be upset. I didn't want to get you involved in this. And she was frustrated because she hadn't been able to make the decision on her own to make it stop. And then she said she felt stupid because she knew better. And I think she felt guilty that she had allowed her and given her permission to use the car so that it wasn't completely my cousin's fault, which I don't agree with because I think she abused my mother and took advantage of her.
Every day I worry what's going to happen. And if they take the house, I don't even want to think about it. I don't know where I'd go or what I would do. Because I love my home, and it was my home, and it was my salvation when my husband died. My husband sat here, I sat there. It's very scary because I'm 76 years old, and where do I go from here?
I asked someone for some advice on elder abuse, financial elder abuse. I'd also spoken with the credit card company who said that they would pursue criminal charges if my mother authorized them to do that. But by doing so, that would have to give them permission to go after my cousin. And my mother really didn't want to do that. And I can understand why, bringing up the police into something that was technically initially a family matter was really hard for my mom. So that's how I got in touch with a financial abuse specialist, attorney specialist that came out and interviewed my mother and talked to her about the case and talked to me about it. Basically, she agreed to represent my mother in at least a dialogue with my cousin on trying to arrange some sort of a formal legal repayment schedule.
Always feel free to contact people such as experts in the district attorney's office, or in many states, there are protective services, adult protective services. Call those people, go to them, find out, tell them what you've observed. You see, they can show up with the proper legal background and say, I must see Mr. Smitherton, age 96. His family says they are concerned about his welfare, and they have legal authority to go in, see him, evaluate him. And any elderly person listening to this, friends or relatives of elderly, should take heart that there are things that can be done.
It was a big deal for him to turn his life over to me, to let me fight all of this for him. And that meant putting his story out there so that we could get help. There wasn't any way I could do this other than to say, hello, DA's office, we need help. And this is what's happened. In the end, we were able to, because of the DA's office and the law office, we were able to get everything back into Harry's name except for all the cash he ended up eventually giving.
I asked her one time, well, what do you tell people if they call you on the phone and they start to pressure you? And she says, well, I tell them I'm not interested and I hang up, or I tell them they got to talk to my kids.
And it's just kind of being sure that you tell folks that, you know, I'm aware of what's going on with my mother or parent, so you can't take advantage of them because I do know. And maybe they won't speak up for themselves, but somebody will. Mm-hmm.